Of course I appreciate that. Of course I appreciate that our blocking the centre of London, our blocking all of the roads and all of the bridges in central London has had an adverse effect on some people. Of course I appreciate that. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry that that man who had a heart attack in front of Parsons Green tube station wasn't able to get an ambulance on time, to take him to the hospital on time, and as a consequence, he died. Of course I'm sorry that that man died at age 65 of a heart attack. I mean, it could be said that if he'd eaten a vegan diet, then his heart would have been in better condition, and so he wouldn't have had a heart attack. But that's not the point. He did have a heart attack, and I'm sorry that the ambulance wasn't able to get him to hospital on time, and I'm sorry that none of his children were able to say goodbye to him. Of course I'm sorry. But we've been forced to do this. We've been forced to do this because people like you in the media, if we don't do this, if we don't bring central London to a halt, to a complete standstill, and cause lots of people who are running small businesses and keeping the economy afloat to not be able to make any money and force them to literally have, like, no money for a couple of weeks, if we don't decimate the conditions of the working class in London and make them even poorer, then people like you don't listen to us. So we have to do this. It's the only way that we can draw attention to the fact of all of the suffering that's going to happen in the world if we don't do something about carbon emissions and climate change. And of course I appreciate that that man's suffering and his family are going to suffer. But I mean, and of course I appreciate we disrupted London. But I mean, rain disrupts London. Rain disrupts ambulances. Rain could have stopped him getting to the hospital on time and stopping him from dying. It's just that on this occasion, we did so. And what we're doing is important. What we're doing is saving the world. I mean, yes, he suffered and yes, he died, but the world is suffering. The world is dying, and that is surely much more important than one 65-year-old man dying of a heart attack. Well, I know his children might not think that way, but they're not being rational. I mean, they're just thinking about their one person that they like that's attached to them. They've got to think about the whole world. The whole world is suffering. The whole world is dying. Yes, of course I understand. Of course I understand that they're sad that their father's died. But shouldn't they be more sad that there's going to be more people dying? There's going to be mass death. Life on Earth will be extinct in 12 years' time unless people accept our demands. And they will only accept our demands if we bring London to a standstill and cause economic ruin for millions and millions of people. What are our demands? Our demands are perfectly reasonable. It is that the government and the opposition in the UK agree to tell the truth about climate change, that they ban all carbon emissions and all cars by next year, and they abolish Parliament and set up a citizens' assembly that is ruled by us. That is all we are asking for. People have to understand they are global citizens. They are global citizens, and they have responsibilities, not just to themselves and their fathers who die of heart attacks, but to the whole world. We have been forced to do this. We have no choice other than to bring central London to a halt. And we're going to keep doing so. We're going to keep disrupting people's lives until they listen to us and let us completely rule and dominate their lives and micromanage their existence in every way according to our own uniquely correct ideology. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Right, today I'd like to talk about climate change, and specifically I'd like to talk about the Extinction Rebellion. The Extinction Rebellion that is happening in London right now. What has happened is that a group of hippies and virtue signalers and wishy-washy liberals and people who don't seem to have any job to do but have money somehow have brought the entire of central London to a standstill, and as a consequence of what they've done, people with small businesses who are the backbone of the British economy and are the reason why they have the money and the lifestyle which allows them to go around virtue signalling like this, those people are being appallingly affected. Ambulances are having trouble getting through to hospitals, and it's perfectly possible that someone who might needlessly have died. Who knows? They have brought central London to a standstill, and our supine police have done absolutely nothing about it. And I was contacted by one of you and asked if I might consider doing a video about this, and I thought, I'm going to go for it. They are blocking roads. Interestingly, they have gone to Smithfield Market, which is an ancient meat market just outside the City of London, and set up camp there. So they're particularly trying to ruin the large lives of the various butchers and so on that work in Smithfield because they don't eat vegan food, and so this makes them really, really bad. Who are these people? Why are they doing it? And what is going on? What is the evolutionary psychology of the climate change movement? Well, I've been giving this a bit of consideration. Essentially, I think we can regard it as a religious movement, an extension of Protestantism, an extension of Calvinism, an extension of Christianity. The essence of the movement is this: there's this thing called climate change, and climate change is really bad. It can kill us. Climate change is something that we are to blame for. It is because of intrinsic problems in us that this climate change thing has happened. Whether or not it is caused by us, it's not really the point. But the point is, in a sense, we must atone for it. We must do things to atone for our own sinfulness in causing climate change. We must wear sackcloth and ashes. We must reduce our lifestyle. But we must also institute what they call climate justice, which is that we must permit third world countries, who we have supposedly exploited by giving them the Industrial Revolution and inoculations and a much higher standard of living and so on, and that's a population boom. We must, to atone, we must allow them to continue to pollute the world violently while we very heavily reduce our own emissions to practically zero. And then we have atoned for our sinfulness in causing climate change. And this is a sinfulness which ultimately, I think, goes further than that. But that's what we must do anyway. And once we do that, then we will reach some sort of kingdom of heaven on earth. Now, as for the cause of the causing climate change, I think this is just regarded as one of many sins. The essential idea is that we are inherently sinful people. We are sinful, we Europeans, because of climate change, which we have caused, because of imperialism, because of everything we've ever done. We essentially have a kind of original sin. And in days of old, we could purgate this sin by accepting that Jesus was our Lord and Father, and by following the various dictates of the church, and by trying to be as ascetic as possible. That is how we could atone for our inherent sinfulness. And now the sins have changed, but the fundamental attitude that we are bad and we are dark and the world is dark and it's an evil place and we must atone for our sinfulness, that is still there. So I see this as an extension of Christian theology, and more specifically an extension of Protestant theology and of Calvinist theology, in the sense that there's almost nothing we can really do about it. It's our fault, but it doesn't really matter. It's much more the process of doing it that's important than what we actually achieve. We have to understand we are sinful people, we are bad people, and we can make ourselves, and we can atone to, there's no God here really, but there's some sort of cosmic something which is not in order, and we can atone for our evil by basically taking ourselves back to the Stone Age and allowing others, other races, other groups to dominate over us. And then we have fully atoned and the kingdom of heaven will be reached. This is extremely similar to Christian theology. The idea that, again, advocated by Christ and you know, more clearly by Protestant theology, that you have a situation where we are sinful people and we must therefore atone for our sinfulness by taking the side of the dispossessed, by taking the side of the poor, by elevating the poor, by worshipping and idolising those who are poor, by bringing ourselves down to the standards of the poor, and in doing so atoning, but in doing so also expressing our virtue and our adherence to the dogmas of the group by being as supposedly poor as possible. This is the essence of the movement. This is can be understood, therefore, as a Christian sect. It follows Christianity in very, very clear and fundamental ways. It is an atheistic development of Christian theology. Now, who involves themselves in this? Well, first of all, you can see you have this idea, you play for status by stressing how puritanical you are, And in doing so, you get status in the religious society that these people have set up, which is the climate change and whatever left-wing society. So who does it attract? Well, overwhelmingly, it attracts the white middle class. If you look at these climate change protests, they are overwhelmingly white people. They are overwhelmingly educated people, middle class people. So why are they attracted to this kind of movement? Well, first of all, how do you play for status if you are a member of the middle class? If you are a member of the middle class, you don't want people to regard you as working class. Working class people play for status by simply trying to look like they're rich. Now, if you're middle class and you do that, you have these status signals of wealth, you play for status with a sports car or whatever, people will regard you as working class. Now, of course, you don't want to do that because it would be awful to be perceived as working class. And you don't have the money and the refinement and the breeding to come across as being upper class. You will be recognised as the parvenu that you are. And so historically, what the middle class have always done is they've played for status using education and morality. They stress what they regard as these non-materialistic values of being highly educated and of being highly moral, of being highly woke. Now, in times of yore, therefore, it was the extremist religious movements. If you think about the Victorian, the most puritanical Victorians that were completely anti-sex and highly censorious and all this kind of thing, they came out of the middle class. The working class were regarded as this degenerate, drunken, highly sexed group of people who the middle class wanted to perceive themselves as better than. The upper class were, of course, wealthier than the middle class, and so the middle class saw themselves as inferior to them, but they saw themselves as superior in the sense that they were more moral, in the sense that they were more hard-working and whatever, and in the sense that they were more educated, and related to these two factors, really, in the sense that they were more religious. And so this was how you played for status. And you'd get these moral panics throughout the Victorian era, where these religious fervour panic, anti-alcohol, and there's many other examples of them, that were spearheaded by the middle class. So this should be understood in a history of that, in that history. The middle class always have and always will, it seems, use morality and education as their means of playing for status. So why is it that they are attracted, however, to this specific climate change rebellion or whatever it is? Well, firstly, intelligence, according to my colleague Michael Woodley's research, the cultural mediation hypothesis, intelligence predicts being able to perceive whatever is the social norm at any given time, and wanting to gain social status. And so you can sniff the air almost and understand what is the social norm, and you use sort of effortful control to persuade yourself of the veracity of that social norm, to convince yourself that it's true. So therefore you adopt that social norm, in this case, and for a long time it's been liberalism, but you need to play for status within that social norm, and so you incrementally push it in slightly further. So if, for example, it has become the social norm to accept homosexuality as a socially acceptable thing to do, which happened, I suppose, around the 1990s, well, you of course accept that, but you can't leverage status with that to any great extent, because every middle class respectable person is going to accept that. And so consequently, you slightly push it further by arguing that there should be equal rights for transsexuals or whatever it happens to be. And this is one of the means by which there is this leftward drift that is precipitated by the middle class. In much the same way, if you look at the puritanical 19th century middle class moral panics, they would start off by saying, oh, well, we shouldn't have alcohol as strong as this, we should regulate drinking hours or whatever, and then it becomes that you shouldn't drink any alcohol at all, and so on and so on and so on, until you have these highly puritanical church ladies who in many ways are quite a good parallel with the hysterical, woke, screaming feminists that we have today. So that's the first thing. Intelligence predicts that you would be more, in a sense, ideological. Intelligence, and therefore more attracted to a movement like this. A second thing that intelligence is associated with is empathy, is generalised empathy. So again, you would expect them to be highly empathic in a general sense, whether it's to the world or to other races or whatever. In other words, you would expect intelligence to predict being lower in kind of ethnocentrism, and there is a degree to which that is the case. Thirdly, you would expect intelligence to predict the ability to overcome evolved instincts. Intelligence is about solving problems. How do you solve problems? You have to be able to think outside the box. You have to be able to overcome your cognitive biases to think in a moderately original way and solve the problem. So intelligence allows you, to some extent, to overcome cognitive biases. We have evolved cognitive biases towards things like ethnocentrism, towards religiousness, which tends to be associated, as I've looked at in other videos, with ethnocentrism. And so intelligent people are going to be more likely to overcome these evolved cognitive biases towards whatever ideological precept they're being told about, such as generalized empathy. So middle class and socioeconomic status is associated with intelligence, but we would also expect it to be associated in a context in which the dominant value system has become left-wing, with being left-wing and with pushing this left-wingness in a more and more extreme direction, such that it's no longer good enough to be vegetarian and everybody has to be vegan and we shouldn't eat meat and we shouldn't fly aeroplanes and we shouldn't use anything other than electric cars and we should limit our use of these. And basically this highly puritanical way of thinking. I am more puritanical than thou. The old idea when I was a child, the more middle class you were, the less television you watched. Yeah, the super middle class thing was to have no television at all. Think how middle class that was. So this is the kind of thing we're talking about, this self-denial as a means of gaining status, because there is a realization that in this ideological, in this religion that they're basically part of, you need to show your commitment to the religion, and you do that by being slightly more puritanical than the last man. The second issue that predicts socioeconomic status is general factor of personality. This is a combination of the personality traits agreeableness, that is to say altruism and empathy, conscientiousness, that is to say rule following. Those are the main things, the main components of them actually. That an optimum level of neuroticism, things like social anxiety and worrying. These have been shown to be associated with academic success because they act as a motivator. So these predict socioeconomic status, of course, but they also predict neuroticism and anxiety are also a factor in middle classness as a consequence. As I say, they predict educational success. Now, what neuroticism is also associated with is things like cults and fundamentalism and periodic fervour. So people that are in religious cults tend to be mentally unstable. They tend to join religious cults in periods of depression and then leave them when they get better. People who have periods of religious fervour and religious experiences are mentally unstable. They are high in neuroticism. They become so high in stress that their body kind of reacts by overwhelming them with calming feelings, which are interpreted as a religious experience. And so they become religious for a while. Religiousness gets higher at times of stress, and particularly mortality salience, but also in general at times of stress. Religiousness, it could be argued, has evolved as an adaptation to deal with stress and thus allow you to survive. Now, there is a moderate degree to which being middle class is associated with elevated stress, because it helps you to be middle class if you're moderately stressed, because it acts as a motivator in education and so on. So you're going to expect these people, the middle class, to be more likely to suffer from things like depression and anxiety, and thus more attracted to new religious movements and cults and things like this, which and periodic fervour, which will play on their anxiety. So this is yet another reason why these people will tend to be so middle class. Their elevated anxiety. Yet another reason is this issue that I've looked at in many videos of the spiteful mutant. This is the idea that until the Industrial Revolution, we were under these conditions of Darwinian selection, 40% child mortality every generation. This removed from the gene pool people that carried mutant genes, which meant they had a bad immune system and consequently they couldn't survive childhood illnesses. But the brain is 84% of the genome, and consequently it's a massive target for mutation. And so mutant genes of the body will tend to correlate with mutant genes of the mind. Consequently, as we have failed to purge the society since 1800, since the Industrial Revolution and the improvements in medicine, as we failed to purge the society of these people with physical mutations, there's also been a rise of people with mental mutations, with mutations that would get you or your society destroyed under times of Darwinian selection, such as believing being an atheist and thus believing life has no meaning whatsoever and that your people aren't uniquely important and the people of God God, such as putting the interests of other ethnicities before the interests of your own ethnicity, such as not wanting to have children and antinatalism and this kind of thing, such as a woman heavily delaying your fertility well into your 30s so that you can't have many children. All of these kinds of maladaptive things, what my colleague Michael Woodley calls spiteful mutants. Now, the process of Darwinian selection would have weakened first among those who are higher up the social hierarchy, and therefore the spiteful mutants would have manifested there first. So, and the heritability of socioeconomic status across time from the medieval period to 1950 in England has been shown to be about 0.7. So basically we're talking about genetic castes. The middle class, the white middle class who we're looking at now on television in London, are the descendants of the white middle class of 1800. And so we can expect them to be more mutated. Therefore, you're going to get these people advocating these maladaptive ideas that would destroy society and would reflect a will to destroy yourself in the middle class. There would just be more of them with these maladaptive ideas. Whereas working class people have been under Darwinian selection until much more recently. They've had high child mortality until much more recently. So you'd expect them to be less maladapted. You'd expect them to have, and also you'd expect them to, because they're lower in intelligence on average, to be higher in instinct, to be higher in our evolved instincts, such as ethnocentrism and things like this. And so consequently, these ideas will come from the middle class, and they will be attractive to people who are in the white middle class. There will be a degree to which members of the elite, members of what we might call the upper class, will be interested in these ideas as well. And you see this with Juliet Stevenson, with that bloke that was in that TV series about Mark Rylance or something, I think his name is. So these people are extremely rich. It's interesting that they're actors, though. Actors are high in openness, which means that they're very open to being indoctrinated. And so if we're talking about some kind of religious cult that also allows you to elevate status, then you can see how they could allow themselves to be indoctrinated into something like that. Being good at acting and arts in general is also associated with being mentally unstable, so you can see how people who are actors would again be attracted to something like that. But perhaps most importantly, these are members of the elite, and they are competing with other members of the elite, and they can and perhaps it wouldn't be the most successful members of the elite, I don't know, but these people would realise that they could gain further status potentially by involving themselves in such a movement. So you can see these different reasons why certain people who aren't middle class, who are actually members of the elite, would do so. But you wouldn't expect there to be much in the way of working class people involved, for the reasons I've already outlined, and you wouldn't expect there to be many ethnic minority people involved, because ethnic minority people have been under Darwinian selection until much more recently than Europeans, and so therefore ethnic minority people will have values and ways of seeing the world. They will simply be less mutated. Okay, yes, you can look at exceptions in terms of cousin marriage or whatever in Islam, in Bradford, causing lots of people that have double doses of harmful mutant genes. But with regard to spiteful mutations that will come along in the population more and more as a consequence of reduced Darwinian selection, you're going to have these people being less mutated, more normal, more close to what we were like under Darwinian conditions than our white people. And consequently, they're going to be higher in ethnocentrism, in the same environment. They're going to be higher natalism. They're going to be higher in all of these instincts, which are highly adaptive. So you're not going to get many ethnic minority people involved. It's nothing to do with them, and they shouldn't be expected to care about it, because they are simply more normal, more sensible in an evolutionary sense, less mutated than our white people. So this then is the situation. This is the kind of people that are involved in it. Now, what is the point from an evolutionary perspective? What is the point of what they're doing? What they're doing, let's not forget, is annoying a lot of people. Annoying a lot of people. A lot of people who are lower middle class or working class and have a business to run. Those people, whatever their ethnicity, they're going to lose a lot of money as a consequence of this. But of course, what has to be understood is that these environmentalists don't care about that. They don't really care, I think, about the environment. We're talking about a religious cult, and we're talking about what a religious cult is trying to achieve. What's it trying to do from an evolutionary perspective by doing this? What are these mutants? Because remember, mutants, people who are maladaptive, want to pass on their genes as well. They're spiteful genes, but they want to pass them on. What's the point of it? Well, with any religious cult, you have to have boundaries and you have to police the boundaries. So you set up this situation where you say, we're all going to die. That triggers people and it triggers their psychological defence mechanisms. The psychological defence mechanisms will include things like joining a group, acting to try and raise their self-esteem, acting to rationalise what they're doing, or whatever. But that's the first thing they do. So they trigger our death response, basically, our mortality salience. And this is going to trigger certain kinds of reaction. Now, the research on environmentalism has found that what it does is it heightens group division, and it does so in two directions. It heightens group division. Some people will react to it by saying, OK, I'm going to join the climate change group, I'm going to try and do something about this. And others will react to it by becoming more fervent in the opposite set of values. This has been demonstrated empirically. They will incline themselves to care less about the environment than they already do. And they will regard themselves quite happily as materialist, as right-wing, as not woke, whatever. That is what they are achieving by doing this. So they are achieving a division in society where you're either with us or against us. Basically, we're talking about an evolutionary battle that's going on within white people, with the left on and the environmentalist essentially on one side, and by bringing about this situation, they are flushing out the traitors. They are flushing out those who are genetically different from them. They are purifying the group. We know that we tend to, from research by J. Philippe Russian, that we tend to be attracted to people that are genetically similar to us on all levels, whether it's friendship, whether it's people that we have relationships with, whether it's who we want to live with, whether it's citations in academia and the race of the person whom we're citing, whatever it is. We're attracted to genetic similarity, and it's forcing this to a head. So that you have to decide, are you with this group of people and their gene pool, or are you with the other group? And there are going to be some who are not sure or are on the boundaries of the two, and they will have to make a decision. So we can understand it in that way. It's a deliberately divisive tactic of the kind you would want to have in a war, in order to be clear whose side you are on. And in doing so, you purify the group and you ensure that the group is more genetically similar than it otherwise would be, and therefore more internally cooperative and more externally hostile, higher in its group sense in positive and negative ethnocentrism. And we know from computer models that it is the more ethnocentric group that eventually dominates. So that's what they're helping to do by doing this. They're creating an us and them situation, and they're therefore helping to create a group which will ultimately be more likely to dominate. If you are them, then you have you start to bring in tests of membership, which are increasingly puritanical and difficult to abide by. So it used to be that you'd have to be a vegetarian or whatever to be one of them, but now they increasingly seem to be demanding that you're a vegan, and they've set up this via vegan food, and they've put out calls saying, "Oh, we need vegan food for our people, and our people are going on hunger strike. They need vegan food now, or they won't be able to survive." So it's a tests of membership of the kind you would get in a fundamentalist group. I did my field work when I was in my early 20s on fundamentalist Christian groups. They'd have these tests of membership in a university context, lots of drinking and smoking and sex with people you don't know very well and whatever. The test of membership was that you couldn't do any of those things. So veganism and whatever, it's a test of membership. That's the whole point of it. And this division is a way of basically a fundamental difference that you get within humanity. We've looked at it in another video. The two dimensions to politics, and politics is highly heritable about point six, traditionalism and egalitarianism. This is what de Jong argues. These are highly genetic issues. Haidt has argued that there's five moral foundations: care, fairness, in-group loyalty, authority, and purity. Now, he argues that basically the left only care about care and fairness, caring and fairness, and the right care about all of these things. Some people have disputed that. They've said, well, also in-group loyalty is important for the right, and so is purity. And to a certain degree, so is authority within their own group. But it's within their own subgroup rather than in the sort of ethnic group as a whole. Another way of looking at it is by arguing that we as humans are evolved to have two sets of values, dominance and equality. as from our hunter-gatherer past. On the one hand, in order for the group to survive, you need to have equality, you need to have everyone being relatively the same so that everyone gets on and everyone cooperates and you're more likely to survive in battles with other groups. On the other hand, you want to rise to the top of the hierarchy of that group. And so you're going to have these two sets of values in the population, dominance and equality. Really, you could even divide it between systematizing and empathy. Empathy, wanting everyone to be equal, you know, kind of female values. Systematizing, wanting to understand things and wanting structures and order and so on. Male values. However you want to divide it, there are these two sets of values. Now, in a society under Darwinian selection, you would end up with the optimum adaptive balance between the two sets of values. The optimum percentage of the population that were very in favour of equality, the optimum percentage of the population that were very in favour of dominance, and the optimum percentages of the population that had the appropriate balance between the two. And you would also end up with the form of religiousness regulating what was the societal norm in an adaptive direction at any given time, and expressing that societal norm as being the will of God. As Darwinian selection has broken down, you're going to get all of this mutation, and you're going to get all of these people moving away from this norm in all kinds of maladaptive directions, so that society is almost pushed to the extreme. More and more people will be very, very, very into equality, to an extent that's damaging to the group. And more and more people will perhaps even be very into dominance values, to an extent that is damaging to the group. But whatever it is, it will be suboptimal. But you'll have this, this will be a highly genetic issue, and you'll end up with this battle between those who will be more genetically similar to each other, who are in favour of equality, and those who will again be more genetically similar to each other, who are in favour of more traditional values, authority, and so on. By having this climate rebellion, you force people to take a side. You purify the fundamentalist, Calvinist climate movement group with their child leader St. Greta, which I also think is very interesting, by the way, that she's a child, because and that she suffers from autism, because again this fits with the idea that you should worship the disempowered. Someone who is autistic would be considered to be disempowered because they're mentally ill or something like that. As long as they're not autistic and expressing right-wing views, then of course they're evil. And that she's female, this is for that reason important. She's Swedish, this makes her, I think, kind of almost exotic, and there's an exoticism. We've always worshipped kind of the East and worshipped the North, and there's this idea in the Bible that St. Augustine argues that the devil lives down but north, and this kind of mystery associated with the north. And also this worship of children. You have this Jesus says truth in the mouth of babes and all this kind of thing. And so I don't think it's any coincidence that it's a child that they wanted to lead their movement. But what it creates ultimately is a situation of war, a battle. Now, to the extent, of course, that we were a highly organized and structured and religious society until the Industrial Revolution, it's difficult to push things in a much more structured direction than was already the case. I mean, Islam perhaps is more structured, but more patriarchal. But whereas it's very easy to go in a maladaptive and less structured direction. And so the way I see it is that the climate change rebellion is a way of creating a clear cleavage in society, a clear division between the mutants and the normal people. The normal people that to a great extent would have survived under conditions of Darwinian selection. I know I always get back to that, but that's the I think it's a crucial theory. The people who want their own destruction, who literally are motivated to destroy themselves and destroy their society, the people who have gone mad and have therefore adopted this maladaptive form of Christianity. Because Christianity, historically, remember, has always been balanced. And that's why it survived. That's why the people who were Christian managed to dominate the world. It helped to create the optimum balance between these values that cause you to be humble and cause you to have low self-esteem and thus cause you to work with people and cooperate with people and thus build up a society that's strong in cooperation, but also that sees outsiders as the devil and thus fights them and destroys them. It helped to elevate these ethnocentric values because it was always balanced with the idea that the outsider was bad. and evil. Now, once that's taken away and you get a kind of pure Sermon on the Mount kind of Christianity, not the Pauline kind, but the kind of pure kind, well, that's not adaptive. And that's one of the reasons why you don't get that much historically in Europe, apart from among tiny little sects that don't last very long because they don't breed, because they're not genetically normal. But now, of course, this or its descendant has been allowed to let rip. And that is what the climate change people are. And it's therefore unsurprising that a lot of them have been to private school and whatever, and are middle class, as I've said. That is what they are. These are subtle this is the essence of it. It is a battle between the normal, genetically normal people, the normies, should we call them, the clowns, and between the mutants. And it brings everything into sharp relief, which is perhaps a good thing, because it means that more and more people will realise that these people will be the road to destruction, and that these people need to be, for the good of humanity, for the good of civilization, for the good of the world itself, these people who claim to care about the world need to be absolutely and comprehensively defeated. Well, I hope this is a bit of interest, and if it is, feel free to subscribe to me. Feel free to, please do that. Feel free to drop me a few guineas on, or even hamburgers, on Subscribestar, on PayPal, or on Patreon. And I will see you soon. And in the meantime, remember to do pretty much exactly the opposite of what the Climate Rebellion people are saying. Let's have a rational and traditional rebellion. And, goodbye!